The headlines: Israel is under mounting pressure to accept a new temporary ceasefire in Gaza amid growing condemnation. The Gaza genocide and the regime's failure to achieve its war objectives. The political bureau chief of Hamas says the Palestinian resistance is still steadfast, despite 75 days of Israeli genocide in Gaza inflicting heavy losses on the occupying regime. And Malaysia bans Israeli-owned and linked ships from docking at its ports as the Israeli regime is facing more repercussions of its genocide in Gaza. Hello and welcome, everybody. 20 Palestinians have lost their lives in the latest Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. The victims were killed in airstrikes in different parts of Gaza, including Deir al-Bala. The death toll is now nearing 19,700 since the war began on October the 7th. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have raided Al Ahli Hospital, knocking it out of service and abducting staff members and patients. It was the last functioning medical facility in northern Gaza. Palestinian health officials say the regime has also turned Al-Auda Hospital and Jabalia refugee camp into military barracks. Internet and phone services have been cut off in Gaza as well due to Israeli attacks. Israel has reportedly signaled readiness for a new ceasefire in Gaza as the international pressure mounts on the regime to end its genocidal war on the besieged Palestinian territory. According to Israeli media, Tel Aviv has informed Qatar about its willingness for a temporary truce. The regime will also allow the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza in exchange for the release of Israeli captives. Meanwhile, Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh is in Egypt for truce talks. A previous agreement mediated by Qatar and Egypt led to a week-long truce at the end of November. During that period, Hamas freed 86 captives in exchange for the release of 240 Palestinian women and children. The regime unleashed its war for the stated goal of releasing its captives and eliminating Hamas. None of the goals, however, have been achieved. International lawyer Barry Grossman joins us now from Bali, Indonesia. Mr. Grossman, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your thoughts on how events have transpired as it's been 75 days of this murderous rampage by the Israeli regime, and yet the international community has failed so far to step in and stop this bloodshed.
Well, ironically, for one of the first times in recent living memory, the occupation have been true to their word, and they're doing exactly what they said they were going to do, which is basically target all Palestinians and decimate the strip and anybody who doesn't completely capitulate in the West Bank until the Palestinian armed resistance is completely decimated, until there's nothing left of them. That in itself being, of course, a quite impossible task, not to mention that the Palestinian armed resistance exists because they're an occupied people and they have a legal right to resist using any and all available means. But it's been made quite clear by the Netanyahu regime from the beginning that they have no intention of reaching some kind of a compromise or a ceasefire. In fact, they bridle at the mere mention of the word truce or ceasefire. Ergo, we've had this language about humanitarian pauses, not that there's anything humanitarian about them. And the fight goes on, and they quite clearly don't care about any Israelis that are caught up in this, and they could care even less about innocent Palestinian civilians who are not particularly political and certainly not part of the active armed resistance. Yet what we're seeing is that we're seeing testimony coming out from reliable sources, European human rights agencies, attesting to the fact that the occupation military forces are carrying out executions in the field of innocent civilians. They have no intention of pulling back. The chances of there being any kind of a reasonable compromise are about zero. they're trying to, that is the occupation, are trying to make some concession to the political sensibilities that are taking hold and trying to win something without giving anything away. And of course, that's not going to happen. We've all heard a lot about these unfortunate Israeli prisoners that were taken. Yet for years, the regime, the occupation, has randomly kidnapped and held without trial or charge thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children.
Sure.
Who many come to age in their prisons. And if all that the resistance is looking for is an exchange across the board, that seems like a reasonable middle ground to start with, bearing in mind that Hamas made it very clear that the siege of Gaza has to end, and the roadblocks put in the way of achieving Palestinian statehood have to be removed. That's ultimately the aim. The world has been committed to a two-state solution for a very long time. Hamas even changed its policy on the matter at some stage a few years ago. But the problem, of course, is every time Palestinians get reasonable and enter into some kind of an accord with the occupation immediately breaches it. And of course, what they envision is a Palestine okay. with no defensive capabilities.
Thank you, sir. We're pressed for time. International Barry Rosson joining us from Bali, Indonesia. We're also now joined by Director of Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, who's joining us from Manchester. Mr. Mohammed, please share with us your views on how events have transpired with regards to the asymmetrical war that continues against the people of Gaza. One of the key comments that were mentioned by the political bureau chief of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, was the fact that the Palestinian resistance still continues. So please elaborate on those comments for us. How important is this, the persistence of the resistance?
Well, I think the resistance that's taking place on the battlefield is one element of it, but I think the Palestinian people themselves are resisting because the clear goal of Israel is and they're explicit about it, to wipe Palestine off the map. This is an attempt to cleanse Palestine of its people by making life unbearable, unlivable, destroying all means of livelihood and mass slaughter so that they will leave. And the Palestinian people, as well as the resistance, have shown that they will rather die on their land and be buried on their ancestral land than leave. So Israel is continuing to slaughter people. On the military front, it's not achieving any of its goals. The hostages are still, the captives are still being held. They have no idea where they are. Militarily, they're taking losses. Their goal of wiping out or ending Hamas looks very unlikely. But I think they're pursuing this strategy of trying to push Palestinians in Gaza into the Sinai. They're now really concentrated in Rafah. And then in the West Bank, which nobody really is talking about, they've armed settlers. Palestinians are being pushed out. 300 have been killed since October the 7th. 236 were killed before October 7th. So there's a total attempt to wipe Palestine off the map. And, you know, they're even threatening parts of Lebanon. And it looks like this. They have this arrogant and crazy view that they can create a greater Israel this time without really assessing their military potential to do so. And the world is just watching. Unfortunately, slaughter is taking place every day. It's one of the greatest horrors, if not the greatest horror since the Second World War, in terms of mass casualties in a short space of time, journalists being killed, UN workers being killed. It's totally and absolutely horrendous and inhumane, and yet this is being done with the blessing of the West. The West is giving them all the time they need to try and achieve this goal of ending Palestine, and they've even made it clear recently, the UK ambassador, Israel's UK ambassador, and also the Prime Minister have said there's no chance of a Palestinian state. So the West is, you know, through these shallow calls for a sustained ceasefire, or, you know, saying it's too early to call for a ceasefire, using their veto at the United Nations, are giving them the full blessing to achieve their object of creating a Israeli state from the river to the sea, and perhaps even a greater Israel.
All right, thanks a lot. Jaghi Mohammad joining us from Manchester. Moving on, if I'm correct, our correspondent Mariam Saleh will be joining us now from the Lebanese capital to tell us more about what's going on. Mariam?
Yes, well, actually, this is not just the first funeral that is conducted and is a procession where you find it in the bordering villages. Actually, we've had several martyrs from that village specifically, and some of other villages as well that are on the border. And you see, actually, which is something remarkable, you see a lot of civilians, a lot of people coming to this town, despite the fact that it can be a threat to their lives, that the Israelis could actually launch certain shelling. Now, the closest shelling that ever occurred against a procession was in one of the towns just several days ago, in the town of Ait Ashab, where the Israelis actually shelled a house just adjacent to where the procession was, actually. And we noticed how the people continued with this procession. Of course, they moved a bit further off from where there was a shelling, but they continued with the procession. They continued to chant slogans with the resistance, in support of the resistance, in addition to chanting slogans against Israeli aggressions, whether in Lebanon or in Gaza. And so this is one of the phenomena that we are seeing recently in South Lebanon. It's occurred in several villages, not only in Ait Ashab. We've had also Kfar-Kila, which is a bordering town as well. We've seen how the people launched and they went to attend those processions. You have women and children attending. You have elderly people going to those processions to attend. So it wasn't only just men and people who are from Hezbollah. Of course, there were Hezbollah processions for those people. They decided that they want to have the burial in their own hometowns. They did not decide to have to bury their martyrs in Beirut, for example, or somewhere further away from the borders. No, you see them going, and with their insistence on going back to those areas. And even during the day, in almost bordering areas, despite the fact that it is evacuated, you have a lot of people going to check on their houses, going to check on their property, on their homes, picking up some stuff, maybe from home. So you have that issue on a daily basis. You don't have people leaving for good, as we see in the settlement site. And we've heard from the Israeli officials something which is phenomenal. We've heard how they are saying the tables have turned, that in 2006, before that, during the occupation, you always had displacement of the Lebanese people. The Israelis enforced a buffer zone in the occupied territories where many people were forced to leave. They were, or else they would always be arrested and persecuted by the Israeli occupation and their collaborators. Now it's the other way around. You have a buffer zone that is in the settlement area in occupied Palestinian territory where the Israelis were forced to evacuate. The Israelis army is only there as a military zone. Even Israeli soldiers were forced to evacuate many of their posts that are along the border and are under the scrutiny of the resistance. And so this is why we can definitely see the tables have turned. You have the officials on the settlements and the settlers themselves always stressing to the government that they have not protected them. They were incapable and they failed, actually, in making them feel protected and secure in that area, and they would not go back. until they know that, for example, they've eradicated Hezbollah. And we have a lot of talk about this from Israeli officials saying that the next in line after Hamas is Hezbollah. And of course, a lot of analysts have ridiculed such claims. They said they are incapable of getting rid of the resistance inside Gaza, and we can definitely see that. What would their case be with Hezbollah, which is, of course, a much stronger resistance? And as you can see, despite the fact that it does have martyrs, it is considered an upside for the resistance that it does have martyrs. They're still going to bury their martyrs in the bordering towns right under the shelling, and that this has not stopped them from continuing their aggression, from continuing, of course, the operations in South Lebanon. The Israelis, of course, continue their shelling. We have a lot of Israeli shelling continuously all along that area. Despite all of this, you still have people, like I said, going back to that to their towns. Now, at the same time, you have a lot of pressure coming, political pressure from the United States. Even now, France is being part of those channels. They're trying to say they're using diplomatic channels, but actually what they're doing is blackmailing the Lebanese on issues pertaining to the election of the president, the election of a new chief of the army. And so we have a lot of things playing out now in light of this, while at the same time, Hezbollah has said that this is a separate issue. This is not something that they can bargain on, that when it comes to resistance operations, they will continue to launch those operations because they believe this is part of their responsibility and retaliation for the crimes that have been committed in Palestine, in addition to support for the resistance in Palestine.
That was Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Thank you, Mariam. Moving on, Malaysia has banned Israeli-owned ships and other vessels heading to Israel from docking at all domestic ports in reaction to the regime's bloodshed in the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, in a statement, said his government's decision comes into immediate effect. Any vessels en route to Israel will also be banned from loading cargo. The statement said the restrictions are a response to Israel's violation of international law through continuous massacres and atrocities against the Palestinians. Anti-Israel campaign group Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS movement, had urged Kuala Lumpur to stop providing Israel with shipping services. Malaysia is a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and does not have diplomatic ties with Israel. Anwar has also refused to bow to Western pressure to cut ties with the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. In West Asia, the Yemeni army has also conducted several operations against Israel-bound ships, seizing some of them in the Red Sea in recent weeks. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet, despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy.
Hello there, and welcome to the second segment in our two-part edition of Bazaar. Last week, we discussed the knowledge-based production of potatoes in agriculture and how technology has helped expand this sector. This week, the program focuses on livestock rearing and all that goes into producing high-quality meat and dairy. Yum, yum. So stay with us as we check out their economic and national food security contributions. Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested. Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs. Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
Twenty 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Khorasan Razavi province specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechi, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini-tubers. So what is a mini-tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production. You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a solace system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production. As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use.
Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received 3 consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs 1/5 of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging, and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines, and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules.
These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere, stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. And this is your host, Sayyid Mustafa. For the past few episodes, we've been discussing probably one of the most important topics we have in terms of, you know, social interactions that we have among ourselves, and that is the rights of our brothers and sisters in faith. Those people that share the same values, those people that share the same ideals and goals as us. Islam has placed great emphasis on this, and we reached a point where we were discussing what are some of the practical things that we can do in society. And one of the things we discussed was helping feed, you know, people in society. Islam has placed great emphasis on helping others and helping in terms of, you know, providing them food, feeding the poor, whatever you can do in terms of, you know, material help. So there were three categories, and the first was material help. And under material help, we talked about feeding. There's a section in this book that which also talks about actually not just feeding them food, but also fulfilling someone's thirst, right? So giving out water, for example, has been talked about as something that you can do. Apart from giving water, we can also provide clothes for people. A lot of times we'll see, you know, people have old clothes that they're throwing away. We've been told, you know, you don't necessarily need to do that. You can help someone who doesn't have clothes. People also need shelter, so providing home, a place to stay, has been greatly emphasized. And also, you know, helping them with any sort of needs that they have. One thing which I found to be pretty interesting, one act which has greatly been encouraged, is to give gifts to each other. Right? It's something that we maybe don't do as much, but I thought it was a great suggestion to give gifts to your brothers, to give gifts to people that you know, your neighbors. In the hadith, it says that when you give gifts, it removes any grudges, any negativity that someone may have in their heart towards you. So that's also why it's important to be giving gifts. On the flip side, we're also told we should be accepting gifts, right? It's not just about giving them, that when somebody gives you a gift, you should accept them. However, one thing that has to be clarified is that these gifts, we are talking about accepting them from believers. We've actually been told in certain narrations that if you're being given a gift, let's say by your enemy, by disbelievers of Islam, by those that are polytheists, then you should not accept gifts from them. And that, I think, also makes sense because, you know, they'll be trying to take advantage of you. Your enemy will try to take advantage of you by giving you gifts, for example. So this whole story sort of helping others, you know, in need kind of reminded me of a story that of my own life, right? And we will continue discussing that right after we come back from the break.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. there are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So we're back, and we've been discussing what are some ways we can meet other people's sort of material needs. We've talked about, you know, giving them food, clothing them, giving them shelter, providing even water in society. However, we can really broaden this idea of helping others, right? It could be, for example, helping educate someone. It could be in terms of helping someone get married, right? And that's actually the story that I really want to talk about, is my own story of how I actually ended up getting married. I think it will kind of really help demonstrate, you know, how others can come to your aid and how they can come and help you out. So this is kind of a long time ago, almost about 12 to 13 years ago. I was single at that time, and I decided to go for Hajj, right? I had enough sort of financial abilities. I had the time, and I decided to go for Hajj. And Hajj, for anyone who doesn't know, it's the annual pilgrimage that Muslims go to Mecca every year to perform. And one of the, I think, ironic part of the story is that my parents were telling me that, hey, don't go for Hajj right now. And once you get married, you should go with your wife, right? Because it's the type of deed that you only do once in your life, and you want to possibly do it with your wife. I was like, look, I have to go. You know, it's become wajib on me. It's become compulsory. What will I say to God if I die? You know, why didn't I do it? It's because I was waiting to get married, right? So my parents understood that, and they allowed me to go. And while I was there at Hajj, I became friends with a couple, right? You normally go in groups, so I became friends with a couple. And before I really mention, you know, what happened with this couple, one thing that happened is that I was actually doing tawaf of the Kaaba. You know, I was just going around doing the circles that you have to do of the Kaaba. And after completing it, when I sat down to pray, next to me was a scholar from Qom. And we just started talking. I just started introducing myself. I asked about him. He asked about me. We met one more time in the Holy Kaaba. And he started asking me about my marriage plans. And I told him, look, yes, I do want to get married. I'm trying to find someone. He said, you know what you should do? You should do 2 rakat prayers. And you should give these 2 rakat prayers to Hazrat Ma'asume, who is buried in Qom, the 8th Imam's sister, in the city that I'm sitting in right now. And he said, also, you should read Surah Yasin. And I did these 2 things right there and then. And he said, then you should pray for a good wife. And I can tell you, the very next day, within 24 hours, this couple that I had met, I sat down with dinner with them. And they started asking me about my marriage plans. And right in that conversation, the person said, well, the guy that was there, he said to his wife, you know who would be great for Mustafa, who would be a great match for Mustafa? It's your best friend. And he named my wife, right? So this couple played this incredibly critical role in helping introduce me and my wife. And I would say I felt as if my prayers during Hajj were also answered. This couple, I'm indebted to them till this day for introducing, you know, me to my wife. It's not something easy, I would say, to introduce a stranger to another stranger and go through that process, because it doesn't always work out. A lot of people don't want to put themselves in such a position. But these people did, right? And that resulted in something that was really amazing. And I should go ahead and add that before our marriage, my wife had also come to this holy city of Qom, and she had prayed here in the Haram to Hazrat Ma'asume that she would like to come and live in Qom one day, right? And her prayer, I would say, was also answered as well. So these things are important. They don't just have a material effect. They have a spiritual effect. They have a spiritual effect on our lives. They can change the course of our entire life. So that's all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.